Now, before we start, just a few words in general about Tibetan Buddhist art, generally speaking. Tibetan Buddhism itself, as we saw at the very beginning of this series, is a direct continuation of Indian Buddhism. It's almost as though Indian Buddhism, when it died in India itself, was reborn, took a new birth, a new incarnation, if you like, on the soil of Tibet. And just as Tibetan Buddhism is a continuation of Indian Buddhism, in the same way, Tibetan Buddhist art is a direct continuation, mainly, of Indian Buddhist artistic traditions. Speaking more specifically, we may say that Tibetan Buddhist art, Tibetan Buddhist religious art, because as we shall see there is no other practically, continues the Indian Buddhist artistic traditions of the Pala dynasty. The Pala dynasty representing the last phase of Indian Buddhism, the most highly developed phase of Indian Buddhism in eastern India, right down to about 1200 or 1300 AD. And especially, we may say, Tibetan Buddhism continues their Indian Buddhist Pala dynasty artistic tradition in matters of iconography, the way in which images, the way in which Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and Daginis and so on and Dharmapalas are depicted. Apart from the Indian influence, there is admittedly some Nepalese Buddhist influence on the art of Buddhist Tibet, but then Nepalese Buddhist art itself was very deeply influenced by the Pala dynasty Indian art traditions. As for Chinese influence, that we may say is very secondary. The Chinese influence on Tibetan Buddhist art shows itself mainly in matters of detail and in the applied arts. For instance, if we look at the tunkas, the painted scrolls, then we shall see that the iconography of the main figure or figures, the colour in which they're represented, whether red or blue or green, the implements which they bear, the type of expression, the various gestures, the ritual implements, the insignia, the emblems, these are all strictly determined by the Indian Buddhist iconographical traditions. But the details, when it comes to little things like the way in which you paint mountains, or clouds, or streams, or waterfalls, or fruits, or flowers, these things reflect very definitely Chinese artistic tradition. So that one finds in the tunka, for instance, which is one of the main expressions of Tibetan Buddhist art, one finds in the tunka a very charming sort of contrast. One finds the Indian tradition reflected in the iconography, the main figure or figures, even their features, even their expressions. And one finds side by side with this Chinese influence reflected in the natural objects like the flowers and the fruit and the streams and the mountains, and especially perhaps the clouds. Chinese influence, as one might have expected, is much more pronounced in those tunkas and other specimens of religious art produced in eastern Tibet, in the areas adjacent to Tibet itself. So far as decorative art is concerned, one finds that many Chinese art motifs have been incorporated into the Tibetan tradition. For instance, one finds almost everywhere in Tibetan Buddhist applied art the well-known Chinese symbols of the phoenix and the dragon. The phoenix, of course, represents the yin principle. The dragon represents the yang principle. The yin principle, that is to say, the cold, dark, negative, feminine principle. And the dragon representing the yang, the bright, the hot, the positive, the masculine principle. And these two, the phoenix and the dragon, symbolizing the yin and the yang forces in the universe, these are represented in Tibetan art exactly as in Chinese art itself. There's no difference at all. Whether they appear woven into carpets or carved into the woodwork of shrines, the Tibetan phoenix and the Tibetan dragon exactly reproduce their original Chinese prototypes. So that we may say, if we want to generalize about Tibetan Buddhist art, that it is a sort of blending, a sort of fusion of Indian and Chinese elements. If we want to go a bit further than this, we may say that the specifically religious component of the art is Indian, whereas the secular component tends to be Chinese. In many examples, in many specimens of Tibetan Buddhist art, these two components, the religious and the secular, the Indian and the Chinese, these exist side by side. But sometimes in the best examples, in the supreme examples of Tibetan Buddhist art, one gets a perfect fusion, a perfect blending, a mutual assimilation, as it were, of these Indian and these Chinese elements. And then one may say one gets Tibetan art at its best, at its most perfect. And then it's neither Indian nor Chinese, nor both together, but specifically and uniquely and distinctively and characteristically Tibetan. One may say at the same time, though, that the original Tibetan contribution is rather meagre. Tibetan Buddhist art draws its religious inspiration from India, its secular, more specifically aesthetic inspiration from China. It fuses them into something unique, something perhaps incomparable, but it derives very little, it draws very little from purely indigenous sources.